Hey, Deserving listeners, it's time for me to answer your questions about the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, so let's get to it. Mary from Seattle says, hi, Kirk. Could you talk about projective identification and projection in the context of the Depp Heard trial and their relationship? Yeah, absolutely. So projection is the first thing I'll talk about. It's often misused in the public and among clinicians, usually as a synonym for distortion, but it's not that. The definition of a projection is, in terms of psychological terms, in terms of a psychoanalytic defense, is that we project our unwanted aspect of self onto other people. For example, when children are abused as children, they feel weak naturally, and they internalize that, and over time they really start to become convinced that they're weak and other people are strong, and they don't like that about themselves. They really hate the fact that they're weak, even though it's tragic that they're hating themselves, that they're not weak, they're just being abused, but that's what they believe. And so as a result, some of these individuals, not all, a minority in fact, will hate the fact that they're weak and will project it onto other people and see other people as being weak. And they might even retain this into adulthood when in fact they themselves believe that they are weak. Or, for example, a closeted gay Republican politician who hates the fact that he's gay because of propaganda that he's absorbed in his community, and thus will deny the fact that he is gay, but see gay people everywhere and see them as a threat and try to attack them. Another example is a husband has thoughts about cheating on his partner. He doesn't like that about himself. He has distress about that, or at least he's on the fence. And so he denies that aspect of himself and projects it onto other people and accuses his partner of cheating or wanting to cheat. So these are classic examples of projection. And when we apply the defense of projection to the trial or to their relationship, it depends on how you see the relationship, how you conceptualize it. If we go with the verdict, then we might say that Amber Heard sees Johnny Depp as being abusive when in fact she knows that she's abusive, but she's in denial of that because she hates that about herself. If you are pro Amber Heard, then you would see it the opposite way, right? Another example, if you're in the pro Johnny Depp side of things, is that Amber Heard accuses Johnny Depp of constantly publishing public lies about their relationship when in fact Amber Heard is the one that is doing that. She doesn't like that about herself, or she's busted up about it. You know, she's ambivalent about that aspect of herself. She goes into denial of the aspects that make her look bad and feel bad about herself, and she projects it onto Johnny Depp and says, how come you're going to the tabloids and TMZ when in fact she knows that she's the one that does that? And if you're in the pro Amber Heard side, then you would see it the opposite direction. Okay, so that brings us to projective identification. And I'm going to describe to you my conceptualization, and the concept has been in the literature for over 100 years, starting with Melanie Klein and others in the early psychoanalytic community in the early 20th century. So there's been a lot of different definitions. My conceptualization is very similar to the original, but it is different. And the way I use it is very similar to the way Otto Kernberg uses it. I find his literature on projective identification to be very familiar to me. So projective identification is an extension of projection. It's projection with something else. And in essence, we again project by projecting onto others unwanted aspects of ourselves that we don't like about ourselves. This is mostly subconscious, unconscious. But we also socialize the target to behave in accordance with the projection. The following example is going to be in accordance with the verdict, which I know most of you actually agree with. So I know some of you don't, and so I hope you can tolerate that. Of course, I don't know if the trial was just or correct or right or right-headed. I'm just going to speculate about projective identification and its use within their relationship based on the consensus opinion, not only with the jury, but also with the public and also with all the attorneys that I've spoken with. But we don't know. It's possible that the verdict was wrong. But anyway, so number one is that the self internalizes a dyad. This is very important in the analysis of projective identification. It's very important to start from the beginning and start with the fundamentals. Otherwise, everything gets thrown off if you don't start with this step, which is that you have to conceptualize realize. And sometimes we have to make some guesses because our internalizations can happen pre-5 years old. So sometimes we don't really know, and we have to infer based on our current behavior and predictive identification processes that a certain dyad must have been internalized. So when I mean dyad, that means two people. And so when we're young and we're having an interaction or we're observing an interaction between two people, we tend to absorb that. In the same way that we absorb language and culture and mannerisms, we internalize relationships and emotions as templates for how to view the world and how to view ourselves. It's complicated, but that's it in a nutshell. And so, for example, we will internalize our relationship with our parents. So if our parent is soothing us and we are in need of being soothed, you know, we're distressed and our mother comes to us and soothes us, we internalize that dyad. And it's important to have it as a dyad, because if we don't conceptualize it that way as a, because some people say, well, I internalized my mom. And that's not wrong to say that, but eventually we need to recognize that we've internalized both sides. We internalize the other, but we also internalize a vision of the self, an interpretation, a perception of the self. We are frequently observing ourselves as we're in interactions with other people. And so we internalize both of those aspects, the self and the other. And so later on, we will either identify with one side or other. It makes sense when I get down there. But anyway, so over time, as long as the interaction is intense and chronic and or patterned in a certain way, we will internalize that and it will become a part of ourself. A one-time interaction that is very intense can become a very important part of ourself. Whereas if we have one or two interactions of a particular style, but it's not very intense and it isn't very frequent, then that won't really become a significant part of the self. But anyway, so with Amber Heard, we know that her father was violent and abusive. We don't know much beyond that, or at least I don't. And so I can only take guesses as to what was happening. But if we just hypothesize here, either Amber Heard was abused herself and she internalized the abused, hurt, weak self and the rageful, abusing, maybe pursuing father. And so that became a dyad. Or she observed in her parents an abusive father and a distancing, weak mother, a hurt mother, and a victim mother. And for Johnny Depp, we know that he was abused by his mom. So in all likelihood, given this model of understanding what's personality, is that he internalized that dyad of mom berating him and abusing him and himself feeling sad and berated and abused. So number one is we internalize that dyad. Number two is the interject, the internalization or the interject, the dyad, creates psychic problems later on in life by affecting our behavior and our self-dialogue. So for Amber Heard, if we go with the trial and the consensus, is that Amber Heard seemingly internalized the dyad of an abusive father and an abused self or an abused mother or both. And so as she is living her life, that is a part of her, that dyad is a part of her. Both aspects are a part of the self and can motivate behavior and perceptions and beliefs and thinking and all that kind of stuff. And so she starts to actually become pursuing and abusive and demanding of other people, maybe even in her teenage years. Again, it's complete speculation. And there's a part of her that is recognizing, oh, you're acting just like your dad. And the self has a tremendous amount of shame about that because they know how bad it feels to be abused in that way. And so to realize, wait, I am now the abuser, is a terrible realization that the ego cannot tolerate upon first glance. And so it needs some way of dealing with that, which I'll get to later. The other aspect that will emerge is that there's a lot of self-talk. Because of this dyad is on the inside of us, the internalized abuser will say a lot of bad things to the abused internalization of the self or the mom. And so there'll be these voices that will be directed inward of, you're a piece of crap, you're terrible, you deserve this, you don't deserve anything good, you deserve everything bad, that kind of thing. And so that dialogue is going on, that self-talk is going on, and that's very distressing, right? With Johnny Depp, very similar hypothesis that he has internalized his mother. He has a lot of that dismissiveness and anger and ways of putting other people down and having nicknames, which we saw him do. He had a lot of ways of having nicknames for people. I don't know if it was abusive, but we did learn from his testimony that his mom would call him, you know, certain names and the siblings' names. But anyway, so he starts to realize in his teenage years or early adulthood that he is kind of like his mother. He has aspects of himself kind of like his mother, maybe even as early as his early teen years. And he has tremendous shame. Also, he has this negative self-talk that's been internalized from his mom, and the dyad is inside of him, and his internalized mom is berating himself, saying that he's worthless and whatnot. And so he starts to use substances to cope with that. Amber Heard seemingly started to develop a pursuing, demanding, desperate way of trying to cope with what was happening in her, trying to get attachment security through those behaviors. Who knows if any of that is right, but if we're just hypothesizing. So number one, you have internalizing a dyad. Number two, you have the interject starts to create psychic problems. I'm actually skipping a lot of steps just to make it more easy. But number three is the ego. And again, this is my model. You're not going to hear this exact way of describing it from other people. But number three is the ego desperately seeks resolution. So we want to recreate the dyad. This is the beginning of projective identification. So defenses are in response to something that's going on inside of us that is distressful. So like think of denial, for example. If someone is drinking all the time and a part of them knows that they have a problem and they have a lot of distress around that, they will go into denial about the fact that they're drinking all the time. And if you talk to them, they're like, I don't have a problem. I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't drink last night. And you're like, yeah, you did. So it's a defense against the ego onslaught of realizing the reality. And we do this all the time in various different ways. All of us do. And the greater the problem, the greater the need and the more intensity and the more pathological the defense becomes. So when we have this internalized dyad and we're negative self-talking and we're also realizing we're like the monster that we grew up with, that creates a tremendous amount of psychic stress. And so we need some way of defending ourselves against that, defending the ego from realizing what's happening. And a very effective way is projective identification. And so what we will do is we will recreate the dyad in the external. And what it does is it takes it out of the internal world and makes it external. It's not great that we have a relationship that emulates our childhood relationship, but it's better than it having it be on the inside of us, which creates 10 times as much distress for us. When we're just stuck with our own dyads and our own self-talk and our own shame, it's very distressful. So it's less distressful. It's still very distressful, but less distressful. It's a lesser of two evils if we recreate that relationship, and thus we can attack someone on the outside or blame someone on the outside instead of looking inward. And so why we do this is, one, to distract. We recreate it on the outside to make it external, and it distracts us from our negative self-talk and the realization that we are like the monster. Number two is we're trying to heal. We're trying to create a corrective experience. This is all subconscious, by the way. So we are trying to recreate the dyad, hoping that it will go better this time, and thus we can start to heal. This is where therapy comes in. Projective identification actually happens in therapy. Someone with borderline personality disorder will sit in my office and will try to get me to abandon them or betray them in some way, and I'll get to more of that later, and I will not abandon them and I will not betray them. I'll do everything I can to prevent myself from doing that. I'll do everything I can to counter that socialization, that influence, that manipulation. And by proving to the person with borderline, suffering from borderline, that I am here to stay and that I'm not going to harm them, I'm not going to exploit them, I'm not going to abuse them, then they internalize that and they can start to heal from that. They can start to trust themselves and trust other people. And that new relationship becomes internalized and that becomes another dyad. And if we do that often enough, that dyad that is positive to the self becomes bolstered and more large and more effective in the personality, and the other opposing dyad becomes diminished and starts to go away. It never completely goes away, but it becomes less of a part of the personality. And thus, when they leave my office, they start to have positive self-talk and they stop acting like the monster and they start acting more like themselves or me in this new dyad interaction, if that makes sense. So when people are recreating a relationship with the monster by finding a monster or by being a monster and finding someone like themselves to be a monster with, they are subconsciously hoping that it will be corrective, that it will go different this time, but often it doesn't, right? And number three, we create this dyad over again to soothe because we are familiar with it. It's the devil we know. By recreating something that we grew up with, it feels familiar and it soothes us. Primarily because the monster often wasn't completely a monster. They were good to us, they provided security, they might have been very tender with us. And so that's what we associate with love and security is also the monster, unfortunately. So we're recreating it as a way of trying to return home, if that makes any sense. So those are the three reasons: distract, heal, and soothe. Number four is that the ego searches for a good candidate to recreate the dyad with. For example, with Amber Heard and Johnny Depp, if we follow the consensus regarding the trial, is Amber Heard becomes attracted to partners who are either easily victimized or will become abusives, because people will identify with either side. So for Amber Heard to externalize that dyad, remember we need to have the recognition, we have that foundation that's a dyad, she can either project herself or her mom, depending on who was the victim, onto other people and identify with the monster, or she can project the monster and identify with the self or the mom. And people tend to, not always though, but they tend to have a pattern around that. And if we go with the consensus and the jury, then it looks like if this conceptualization is anywhere near the mark, then Amber Heard tends to identify herself with the monster and tends to project herself or her mom onto her partners because she's had other relationships in which allegedly she was abusive and controlling. Johnny Depp, on the other hand, is also trying to recreate the dyad, according to this model, and he seemingly has a pattern of identifying with himself and projecting his mom, trying to find people that look like his mom or feel like his mom or treat him the way his mom treated him. It's unclear about this, though, because I know nothing about his relationship with Vanessa Paradis. I know nothing about his relationship with Winona Ryder. We heard a little bit from Ellen Barkin during the trial about their relationship, but very little information. So, and the other thing about this is, even though the primary identification for Johnny Depp might have been himself and he's projecting his internalized mom onto his partners and he's trying to find someone that agrees with that, he might occasionally flip that. And there are mixed presentations where people consciously feel like themselves, but they are acting like the monster, if that makes sense. So it's not always just like the other person is always a complete representation of the other, and the self is always a complete representation of the self. You know what I'm saying? Anyways, it's getting into the weeds, but... And along those lines, going off this model, and this is all complete speculation, for Johnny Depp, when he was sober, he might have a really easy time identifying with the self side of the dyad, and when he got intoxicated, it would flip and he would become more like the monster, and he would project himself, the vulnerable victimized self, onto other people. And this lends itself to some of the data. There are indications that, I think Johnny Depp even testified to this, that when he would be in a very distressed state, when he's writing on the lampshades and the window, it seems as though there's a possibility that a lot of those statements were berating him, that he's berating himself. And that was that negative self-talk emerging under great distress. And incidentally, this is why some people with a lot of that voice from the outside when they're children telling them that they're an idiot or they're getting the message that they're an idiot, as an adult, when they make a mistake, you'll hear them, you know, think of Napoleon Dynamite, will say things like, idiot, you know, because they're berating themselves. But that's not them. That's the internalized voice of the other. So that was number four, is to find a good candidate to project one side of the dyad or both onto the other person. And by the way, people who have similar dyads that have been internalized as children tend to be attracted to each other because it makes it so much easier to project one side onto the other person. So step five is to solidify the relationship, because once we fall into a very easy projective identification situation, we want it to stay. We need it to persist, because if that person moves away from us, if we break up with them, then we have to turn to ourselves. So we want to solidify their relationship. And one of the ways that the ego does this for us is that it promotes love for the other person and intense attraction, which we did hear from the two of them. Not that everyone who falls in love is due to this reason, but it is a conceptualization for why, for some people with unresolved dyads, with unresolved relational traumas, they tend to fall deeply in love with all the wrong people. And when they meet someone that's really healthy for them, they don't feel as much love. But according to at least my model of thinking, the intense feelings that they have towards the wrong person isn't actually love. It's the self tricking the self that it's love, because the self, the ego, wants to use projective identification with this person because the person is so perfect for that. It's a similar process that when people are suffering from addiction, that they will have a best friend that they use with. And then when they stop using the substance and they recover from their addiction, a couple years later, they look back at the person and are like, why was I friends with that person? And it's because they used with you and they justified your use. And so by being with them all the time, you could go mutually into denial about your use, and your subconscious mind tricked yourself into believing that the person was great and that you shared so much in common, when in reality, it was just a very comfortable relationship that allowed a defense to manifest. Number six is the ego socializes the other person to agree with the projective identification. So this is really where the projective identification comes into the concept of projective identification. It's really what separates from projection. And for example, Amber Heard might subtly attack Johnny Depp to provoke him to leave her. We don't know if this is accurate, but we at least heard that a pattern of theirs was that they would start to escalate and then he would leave. So according to this model, it could be hypothesized that she would inadvertently, subconsciously pursue him or attack him or insult him or something, and or, I don't know, make him feel uncomfortable or distressed, and then it would provoke him to leave her. And then as that's happening, she feels abandoned, she feels betrayed, exactly the way she felt when she was growing up. And as he's moving away, that might emulate the way she was moving away as a child, or her mom was moving away. Again, total speculation, I have no idea. And then she could identify with her father, who would become demanding and abusive. For Johnny Depp, he might subtly abandon emotionally with Amber Heard, not physically, but might subtly abandon either through drug abuse or just a quiet demeanor or something. And that provokes from Amber Heard a sense of anxiety and abandonment, which provokes rage and demanding behavior, controlling behavior. Then he starts to feel abused, just like he did as a child, and the dyad has been successfully recreated. So again, both people, according to this model, are subtly socializing the other person to do the exact behavior that they don't want the other person to do, but unconsciously they're trying to recreate their original dyad of concern. Number seven is the ego feels satisfied with this projective identification and settles in. And so this is the ongoing conflict in their relationship. And lastly, number eight is the self internalizes this new experience with this new partner, and it bolsters that introject. So specifically for Amber Heard, if she were abused by her father, which I don't know, and she internalizes this dyad, which I don't know, and then she recreates it with Johnny Depp, which I don't know, and he starts to move away from her, and she is demanding and controlling of him, while on the conscious mind, in her heart, she feels as though he is abusing her, and this experience gets internalized, because we don't just internalize our early relationship, we internalize relationships throughout our life. We're more of a sponge when we're very young, but we continue to absorb relationships later on in life. And so the initial introject of being abused and of pain is bolstered. It becomes bigger and bigger and more prominent in the personality. And for Johnny Depp, a very similar thing, according to this model, might have happened, where he recreates a relationship in which someone is abusing him in a very unreasonable way by subtly manipulating the other person. Again, it's unconscious, to do and finding someone who is prone to do that kind of behavior. And thus he internalizes that, and his introject gets larger in his personality. And thus afterwards, he hates himself even more and is more suspicious of other people. So I don't know if that made any sense, but that's my explanation of that. And it's kind of advanced stuff. This sort of lecture is what I will teach in graduate school, and it goes over most students' heads, to be honest. I will test them by having them analyze things in their own life around this. And I would say half the students get a little bit of it, and about a third or a quarter of the students really nail it. I'm always really impressed when I meet students. I have no idea which are the geniuses, which are not. I mean, the non-geniuses are still smart, but there's some students that I have that are just like, I only have to explain what I just said, and they're laser focused. And then I read their papers, and they're just like, boom, they got the whole thing. I mean, because most people have never even heard of this concept before, and to hear it in a lecture and be able to apply it in a very intelligent way and systematically going through it in a detailed way, you know, it's very impressive. It's much more rapid learning than I ever did with this concept. But anyway, so again, I want to remind everyone, particularly you pro Amber Heard people out there, because I know you're out there, that I'm not saying that this model coincides with any of the data. I don't know, but I just thought to demonstrate this concept, and the person did ask me to apply it hypothetically to the two of them, that I would just go with the consensus. But you could easily flip it around. If you believe that Johnny Depp was the main abuser, if not the sole abuser, then it's not hard to tweak little bits of what I just said to make it all fit as well. Now, this is not hard science. There's no way to empirically study this model, but it is very helpful in understanding people. Psychodynamic theory and all that is within it, including projective identification and all the other defenses and repetition compulsion, corrective experiences, is the only theory within psychology and psychotherapy that explains all the weird behavior that we do. There are theories that explain a lot of our behavior, behaviorism, cognitivism, other kinds of feminism, social construction, you know, other kinds of theories really explain. But psychodynamic theory really is explanatory on a number of levels. If you've ever had relationship patterns where you're like, how come I keep seemingly getting in the same type of, how come I keep attracting the same sort of person? What's going on here? How come are all men like this? Are all women like this? And this theory provides a way forward that I find to be extremely useful, because not only does it provide a lot of insight so that you can have control over things a little bit, so that when you fall in love with someone or you're attracted to someone, you can have some questions like, well, am I attracted to them for the right reasons or the wrong reasons? But more importantly, you know what to do in therapy to have corrective experiences such that you bolster a specific interject while diminishing another one, so that you don't need to think about things anymore. For you out there who have had that experience where you're seemingly attracted to the wrong person often, or you have a friend like that, it's much harder to strong arm yourself to avoid that sort of partner in the future. In fact, a lot of people just avoid dating altogether. But to tell yourself, okay, I'm not gonna have feelings for that person, or I'm gonna fall in love with a healthy person, even though they feel really boring to me. It's much harder to do that than to actually recover from those relational traumas such that you just no longer are attracted to the wrong people and you find yourself being attracted to more healthy individuals. It's a very simple way of putting it, and it's hard, it takes a long time, but it's worth it. I've done that sort of work with a lot of people. I've done that work myself, and it has a lot of benefits to it. So there are a lot more questions, but the questions were from patrons of the podcast. So I thought the rest of the episode would just be for patrons of the podcast. So if you want to listen to more of me answering questions, you want to go to patreon.com, become a patron, and you can hear this whole episode. Do it if you want to. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do. All right, welcome to the Patron Zone, patrons. Thank you so much for being a patron. We wouldn't be able to do any of this without you, truly. Willow from Oregon asks, my mother is similar to Amber, and I grew up with significant emotional, physical, and physiological traumas. How would you go about having a healthy relationship with someone like Amber? I have been successfully doing trauma and relational work in therapy. End of question. Yeah, well, first off, I'm sorry that you went through that as a child and throughout your life. It sounds like your mother was very abusive. And the second thing I'll say is I'm glad that you've done a lot of trauma and relational work. That's great. Good for you. The third thing I'll say is we don't know if Amber was abusive, but that's the consensus anyway. So I'll just answer the question as to how are we supposed to go about building a healthy relationship with someone who is abusive, you know, whether that's like Amber or someone else. And what I'll say to that is that it's very difficult because it depends on both people, and you obviously have control over yourself, but you do not have control over your abusive mother. And so unless she gets significant treatment or agrees to go to family therapy and participate meaningfully, there's a chance that her patterned behavior will continue, thus her abuse will continue. So there's that. For me, I'll say that generally speaking, not always, I've been in a number of relationships with abusive people who will traumatize me. And I know that they've traumatized me because when they call me or text me or email me, my hands will start to sweat without even reading their text or without even reading the email. I will just, my physiology just starts to freak out because it's like, oh no, it's them. And there's really only a handful of people that are like that for me. I've met thousands of people and been involved with hundreds of people closely over my 51 years. And there's only a handful of people that can do that to me. And so, you know, my body associates something very scary with these people, even though these individuals have never harmed me. In fact, this handful of people have been very meaningful to me, very dear to me in a lot of ways. I was, you know, close to many of them. But the overall experience, or a component of the experience, was occasional emotional abuse. And so my body flips out. And I'll tell you what I do is I draw boundaries. And I know that sucks. That means that I have to abandon a relationship. It means that I might even have to abandon them and be in another relationship in which that doesn't go well for them. But I don't abandon them usually. I don't say like, I abandon you, but I might just kind of slowly drift away like Homer Simpson into the hedge because I'm just like, well, overall, I don't think this is a good thing for me. So, you know, I'm not saying that's what you're supposed to do, Willow, with your mother, of course, but I just want to say that it's not easy to figure out a way to build a healthy relationship with someone unless they are really recovering, and it could take them decades to recover. Now, you know, maybe there's some way you can have a limited relationship with your mother where you have very brief interactions with her, or you might be able to set some ground rules about some certain things so that you can minimize any kind of damage or conflict or something. But again, she would have to participate in that. And typically, if people are beyond a certain threshold regarding their personality and are abusive, you know, they'll figure out a way. Life finds a way. Abuse finds a way. So even if you set up all these rules, the abusive person will figure out a way to kind of sneak their way in, or will manipulate the rules or something like that. So I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a tough thing to do. And the other thing I'll say is that I've worked with a lot of clients over the years who, because of those early relational traumas and because they're so desperate to have some connection with their parents, they continually bark up that tree to only damage themselves further. So I don't know the answer, and maybe some people just have to go through that process to finally realize that there's really no reason to bark up that tree. But from the outside, sometimes I'm wishing that the individuals would just find a chosen family instead of trying to continually bark up that tree. But, you know, I get it. Denny from Aurora says, I think they both have a history of domestic violence, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp. The thing that people are missing is that screaming and trashing hotel rooms so bad that you get arrested when you are mad at your partner or in a drunken rage is abuse. Everyone says that Johnny Depp has no history of abuse, but I believe that he does. As a DV survivor myself, I wish I knew these signs early on. I grew up in a dysfunctional family, so I thought that it was normal. We need more people out there to tell young people what is emotional and verbal abuse so that we can save lives and stop cycles of abuse earlier. Thank you for sending this out. Yeah, agreed, absolutely. Aaron from Minneapolis says, would you consider doing trial coverage reactions again? The answer to that is yes, if the trial involves something that involves my expertise. Like, I think the Marilyn Manson, Evan Rachel Wood trial, if it even happens, might involve that. And there's a good chance that it won't happen. There's a good chance it won't be televised. There's a good chance that it'll be 15 years from now. So, but yeah, I think I would. I was surprised at how much professional satisfaction I garnered from reacting to this trial. When I first started getting into it, I thought, I don't know, why would I watch a trial? It just seems so, just not really my thing. You know, I've never really cared about, I've cared about the outcomes of trials, but I've never cared to just wade through trials. And I think I've talked about this in the videos that I used to spend a lot of time at the courthouse with my clients for various different reasons. You know, maybe like once every week or every 2 weeks, I would spend half a day or a full day in court, and found it to be extremely boring and distressing and uncomfortable and often unproductive or disappointing. And so to watch trials for me, it's not very appealing, but I was so
interested in this trial, and I was there was so many things that it gave me a chance to talk about. It was so if there's another trial that comes along that is like that, then you'll see me there, I'm guessing. Which is interesting to think about, right? That it's a whole new category of reaction videos and episodes for the podcast that I can make. You know, for all you patrons, I have been talking about how I really want to make a deep dive, right? That's been my whole thing. And the trial actually was during a time when I probably would have had time to do a couple of deep dives. And so I was kind of lamenting that on a certain level. But then I thought, well, the trial kind of is a deep dive. In fact, it's like the ultimate deep dive. It's like 50, 60 hours of interesting material. And, and we got in depth on some really interesting issues. So, maybe I can say, well, at least, I could consider that a sort of deep dive, I suppose, to, sleep better at night because I just love doing deep dives anyway. Aaron from Minneapolis also says, how do you keep yourself engaged in a project like this trial while navigating negative comments and the potential impacts they have on emotions and your security and your motivation? End of question. Yeah, I'll tell you that there was a certain point about 2/3 of the way through my reaction video series where the negative comments really just hit me in the face. And it was not only the numerous negative comments, and by negative comments, I mean comments like, how come you're stigmatizing borderline? And I'm like, I am? That's like the worst thing you could ever accuse me of, really. And I'm thinking, oh my God, am I doing that? I'm trying so hard not to. In fact, I'm really trying hard to destigmatize it while I'm watching this trial. Am I failing at this? And then people, would also say, did you watch the same trial that I did? I mean, you're a complete idiot. Of course, Amber Heard is an abuse victim, or of course, Amber Heard is an abuse perpetrator, and there was just no, it wasn't just trolls trying to prank me, or, these are people that were very passionate and harmed seemingly by me doing this. And then there was groups of people that were trying to get me. They were ganging up on, they were creating subreddit threads to organize themselves against me to try to take my license away or harm me and my wife. And I'm just thinking, my God, if these people are willing to do that, like, what are they capable of, really? Because there's so many things that people could do, right? People could hack into my phone or claim that they hacked into my phone. And, it's just the sky's the limit in terms of what someone might do. And it was completely demoralizing, and I hit a wall, and I I've been through phases like this, not quite like this, but similar moments in my podcasting career that I just keep going. I just I'll rant and vent and get support or strategize or, go to therapy or have a drink with my wife and relax or whatever to cope in various different ways. And I pretty much instantly recover and start making content. But this time, when I felt myself sitting down to make videos, and I was dreading it. And I've never felt that before. I've been a podcaster for almost 14 years. I've never felt that feeling of dread as I was about to sit down and make content for this podcast. I've never felt that before. And I started to feel that. And I thought, oh my goodness, what's happening? Is this like the end of the podcast? Is this what's going to kill me? I mean, is this what's going to kill my motivation to make the podcast, or literally kill me? I don't know. So it was kind of rough there. So I don't know exactly if I made a conscious decision, but in my content, it would sneak out. And I would consider, because I went back and I would always edit these episodes pretty heavily, and as well as the comments videos, because I often will go on weird tangents and cut it out. But I decided to leave it in because, I don't know, I felt like people just should know what I'm kind of going through. And it's not as bad as what other people are going through, It's on the scale of things. But I just kind of felt like I should say something, because you are my community, and the community is hurting me. You aren't hurting me, but the community is hurting me. And I don't know, I just felt like this is a two-way street, right? Like, I do my thing and you do your thing, which involves a number of things, but I think involves like giving me at least some feedback, negative, neutral, or positive, right? Or just some contact with you, right? A number of people were very supportive in some very significant ways, you know, writing like full paragraphs of encouragement that felt very, you know, very, it felt very heartfelt, and it worked on me. And I was like, okay, you know, so I got back most of my steam. I never really got back to 100% though, I'll tell you that much. So it was rough, but not terrible, not like, you know, terrible sort of first world problems, but it was, you know, it was, so how did I get through it? How do I keep myself engaged? I reached out, I became vulnerable, I suppose, and alerted people to my state. And I didn't even ask people necessarily to do this, but it provoked a lot of empathy in people, and they reached out, and that solved my problem. It's a metaphor for everything I talk about, right? When you're hurt by something, by your spouse or something in the world or at work, and you are hurting, a very effective way of getting your needs met is to come home from work or to tell your spouse, hey, I'm hurting. You hurt me, or my boss hurt me, and I don't know what to do. And you don't do it in an accusatory way, and you don't even have to say, hey, I need you to support me right now, because it just will naturally provoke a response to that. I'll also say that my wife was extremely supportive as well. I'll never forget this moment when we were in the kitchen, and I was, I don't know exactly what had happened. Maybe it was sort of at the pinnacle of this, and I started to cry, and or slightly cry at the very least. And the look on her face, it was, you know, just so much care and compassion. And I could sense that she was really feeling it in her chest, you know, the empathy. And she came to me and hugged me, you know, that was a pivotal moment as well. So Christy, patron Christy, says, I work in litigation, and the jury's verdict was bizarre to me. Even Johnny Depp's own witness testified to mutual abuse, which means Amber Heard's statement was not false or defamatory. This will discourage domestic violence victims, both male and female, from speaking up. End of comment. Yeah, agreed. I don't know about the verdict being bizarre, but I do believe this will set us back somewhat regarding building safety for victims to come forward, particularly for women, particularly if they are famous men that they're speaking up against. So yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's possible that this is a step forward in a way for people who are falsely accused. It could give them hope. And I think it might also be a step forward for male victims. So, yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see how this plays out over the next number of years, you know. The misogynists have already been denying women anyway, and they'll undoubtedly use this as ammunition. But I don't know. I could see this being an improvement. I could see this deepening our understanding collectively of all the topics that were covered. Could it have some minor step backwards? Absolutely. But I don't know. I hope that it's five steps forward, one step backwards. I don't know. But but your take is totally valid as well, and it is worrisome to me. Anonymous annual patron says, assuming the borderline diagnosis is correct, would the temporary restraining order and the Washington Post article be a desperate way that a borderline personality disorder person can do to keep a relationship and stay in contact? End of question. Assuming that Amber Heard has borderline, could she have used the TRO and the article and the allegations, the lies, if we're just going to go down that road, could it be a desperate way that someone suffering from borderline would resort to keep a relationship and stay in contact? And the answer is yes, absolutely. I've seen it many, many times. Most people with borderline wouldn't do this, but many will. And I've worked with several clients with borderline. Anyone who specializes in clients with borderline will attest to a minority, but a noticeable minority of their clientele will be embroiled in these kinds of obsessions. And I don't use the word obsession lightly. I had a client once, I'll change details to protect privacy, but I worked with a client who was suffering with borderline, and I actually had never talked with her about her borderline because I didn't work with her for that long. And I also never really felt like I could say things like this without triggering her. So I never really had a full confirmation, but it seemed pretty clear to me that she was suffering from borderline. And prior to me meeting her, she had already been in a several year process of taking elaborate, obsessive legal actions against her enemy. And when I met her and I was working with her, it was pretty much all she wanted to talk about. She wanted to show legal documents to me. She wanted to talk about how her enemy was this and her enemy was that. And her life was going down the tubes because of this. Her parenting, her children were suffering, her family was suffering, her finances were suffering, her occupation was suffering. She was just completely obsessed with trying to take down this previous person in her life and was completely convinced that she was righteous, and no one agreed with her. I won't tell you the details, but everyone involved in the case, including people on her side, did not agree with her, and that would trigger her, and she would that person would become the enemy. And so, yeah, it's rare for people with borderline to do this, but they can. And, you know, people without borderline can do this too, of course, but it can be a pattern that people with borderline can fall into as a way, as you're saying it, to keep a relationship going. I mean, so there's two motivations that I think are at play, potentially one more than the other, but both might be present in that. One, if we just hypothesize Amber Heard has borderline and in fact was not abused, at least to the extent that she claims, then it could be a way that Amber Heard was trying to stay in contact because she was so desperate to not lose him. And there are many different behaviors and audio recordings that we can point to that demonstrate that she had she had those feelings, right? So there's that motivation of like, well, if he won't talk to me, then at least he has to deal with me. And it's like, well, if kids don't get attention, they'll take negative attention. It's that kind of thing. Another motivation is revenge, because the individual is so angry and they're so hurt that they feel justified and righteous in striking back. And so they will do that. The other aspect that my dog is barking kind of messes things up is that the person with borderline in this scenario, this type of borderline, they're so distorted that any information, even their own legal counsel, you know, that is saying to them, you don't have any leg to stand on here. So it's really difficult for these individuals to break out of the obsession. And it's sad to watch, actually. And the client I'm thinking of, I had a limited time of working with her many years ago, and there's a chance that she's still in that pattern of some sort. And it's also kind of scary too, because as a therapist, and I've run into this many times, it's like, well, what if I become the enemy, right? Because I don't feel very strongly connected with this client yet. What if I say something or do something? Because often these individuals will have therapists on their list. You know, it's sort of like if you watch Game of Thrones with Arya Stark, right? That she would just continually build this hit list of people, you know, Cersei, Joffrey, Sir Ilyn Payne, all these, you know, she had this list of people that she wanted to die. And these individuals can be like that. I don't know if Amber Heard is like that, of course, but it's possible that that was part of the motivation of her, you know, continually talking about. Because, you know, strategically, if you're Amber Heard, particularly given the evidence that she had, it, you know, if we were to go back, if you like Amber Heard, and you were to go back in time to 2016, if you have half a heart, you would say, Amber, just let it rest. Like, talk with your friends, go to therapy, but don't publish anything and don't talk about it in public, because you're prone to exaggeration and that is going to bite you in the butt tremendously in 6 years. And it's just a headache you do not want. So just, you know, give it a rest is the recommendation. Now, another recommendation, I suppose, if you're pro Amber Heard, is don't exaggerate. Keep your story consistent with the evidence, and speak out because victims deserve to speak out. I don't know. I'm always thinking, I don't know who I'm talking to. By the way, I polled all y'all as patrons, and it was still similar to the other poll that I gave, which is about 75% of you agree that the verdict was fair or sort of fair, and 10% believe that the verdict was not fair, and I think about 14% of you didn't know if it was fair. So I'm always thinking, well, I should be at, you know, 10-20% of the time addressing, I think, those of you who believe that the verdict was not fair, because there's absolutely evidence to point you in that direction, for sure. Particularly in, you know, in what you're pointing out, an anonymous animal patron, is that it's like, or no, not, it was Christy, patron Christy, you work in litigation, and you're just like, wait, so there's strong evidence that Johnny Depp was abusive, and even if it's mutual abuse, that doesn't mean that Amber Heard was lying, because she, you know, anyway. So, you know, I get it. Anyway, patron Angela from Tucson, she says, is it possible that this couple continues to act out their complicated abuse dynamic using interviews, articles, lawyers, the court system, and public hate campaigns to bully their way into control of the other person? This is how it looks to me. I think they both deserve the public's compassion, but not high five enablement of sad and destructive behavior. End of question. Yeah. So to answer your question, is it possible that they're continuing to act out towards each other as a way of controlling each other from afar? Yeah, absolutely possible. I think the consensus is that Johnny Depp is not doing that and Amber Heard is, but I don't really know that. But yeah, it's absolutely possible that that's what's happening. It's also possible that they both have legitimate gripes and they're speaking out in a righteous way, but who knows. Sarah says, will you react to other trials in the future, Manson versus Wood, or have you had enough after this one? Yeah, as I said before, I'm going to seriously consider it. But honestly, we'll see after I start publishing my Teal Swan episodes, because if that creates a whole other set of headaches for me, you know, I might just go back to talking about Star Wars, which also had its controversies at times, but far less. Anyway. Patron Flavia from Madrid says, how could Amber's allegations ever be proved as true? I'd be interested in knowing any theoretical standpoint regarding her claims and could ever defend them as being true. Well, to me, I don't know, but I don't even necessarily understand your question, but if I understand your question correctly, the way I would answer it is that, as I was saying earlier, if her account matched the hard evidence, then I think she could have won. I don't know that, but, and I've said this a number of times, that if she gave a story starting in 2016 that was like, look, he hit me a few times and he berated me and he threw stuff at me, and there was one time when he really got me in the face, and this is a picture of that bruise on my face, then it would be hard to refute that, right? It'd be hard to say that she's lying. And a lot of domestic violence or intimate partner violence accounts or incidents happen with no one else around. So she has evidence of a bruise, and there you go. So, and it would be consistent with other accounts from witnesses who said that he would fly off the handle sometimes and throw things sometimes and be irate and have a temper at times. So I think she could have won in that scenario. But of course, that's not what happened, right? What happened was she gave accounts of terrible, terrible, horrific, brutal abuse that lasted several minutes, if not a half an hour or an hour, in which she was repeatedly punched in the face with a hand that had rings on it and was thrown across the room and, you know, repeatedly beaten over and over again into unconsciousness. And then we see a picture and there's either a bruise that is, looks like she got hit once, or literally no bruises at all. So it was really hard to accept her testimony at that point. And what I've heard from attorneys is that, generally speaking, if you strongly suspect that a witness lied once, then it's wise to disregard literally everything that they said, because they're under oath and they're not supposed to lie. And so if they lie once, how do you know they're not lying about everything? So legally speaking, I think it the verdict to me makes a lot of sense. I know it doesn't make sense to other people, but legally speaking, it makes sense to me. Now, do I believe that Johnny Depp absolutely told the truth? I actually don't. I think there are times when he was fudging at the very least a little bit, particularly around his drug abuse. He seemed to be minimizing his drug abuse quite blatantly, honestly, which I don't think helped his credibility in my eyes, but I don't know, maybe it worked on the jury. So at least there's that. And around the finger incident, I think I said this in the video that I don't know who to believe. I think I landed on like 60 or 65%. I would bet that she threw the bottle and that harmed his finger. But I would put that percentage even lower that she also followed it up with putting a cigarette out on his face. It's certainly possible that that's true. But I don't know. It just there was some evidence indicating that he might have accidentally blasted his finger off. So it's just it's hard to know. Anyway, you say here also, is there any chance she could be deemed guilty or of breaking the law for continuing to appear on TV shows and offering interviews about the verdict found her guilty of defamation? End of question. Yeah. Well, attorneys say that she could be potentially and theoretically charged with perjury, but it is extremely unlikely. I heard a news story that the Australian government actually might charge her with perjury regarding the dog incident. I'm not sure. It sounded like if they did decide to pursue it, it sounded like it might just be a fine or something. I don't know. Or maybe jail time. I don't know. I don't know anything about that. But the attorneys will say that pursuing a perjury charge is extremely rare in these kinds of cases. And there isn't really enough evidence to go off of to pursue that. You know, if there's obvious lying, that is even more obvious, I suppose, than what was happening in this trial, then the attorneys would say, even then, it probably wouldn't happen. So it's not, there's not likely to be a criminal charge from what I understand. And Johnny Depp could sue her, or I suppose other people could sue her for her, you know, continuing to talk about things. But as I've said before, the attorneys have said that isn't very likely given that Johnny Depp has won, and why would he want to mess that up? Melanie Holmes says, I don't have any questions, but I do appreciate all the time that you invested in the trial and in creating videos with information that illuminate and educate people about mental health issues. Yeah, thank you very much, Melanie. That's very nice of you. Patron from Long Beach, California says, I agree that her writing of the article was responsible for his reputation and job loss, but what about the money? Wasn't that part excessive given her situation financially and losing her reputation and future job loss? Wasn't Johnny only interested in clearing his name? Why ruin her financially since he was abusive to her too? End of question. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know. I'm guessing that the monetary amount that he was suing for, wasn't it like $50 million? He was awarded 10 or 15 or something. I'm guessing it's reflective of his monetary losses. It's probably just some sort of algorithm that they figure out, and there's a common thing. Could he have sued her just for a dollar and claim, look, I don't want money. I just want everyone to know that she defamed me. You know, is that possible? Then, maybe. I don't know. But the way that you phrase this, I don't think is fact. It's possible, but I don't know if everyone agrees with that. You're saying that essentially it's like, well, okay, Johnny Depp, if you're only interested in clearing your name, how come you dragged her through the mud and sued her for so much money and ruined her financially and ruined her career? How come you did that to her? I think pro-Johnny Depp people would say, look, he wasn't trying to ruin her career. What he was trying to do was set the record straight because she was ruining his life and his career. And if the truth coming out ruins her career, then that's her fault, right? So, you know, I think that's what they would say. I don't know who's right, of course. But the other thing that I've heard, and who knows, this is all speculative, is that 'cause from what we've heard, she can't afford to pay the settlement or the fine or whatever it is. And I've heard that in a lot of cases, in typical cases, then there's this whole process of collections and garnering wages and all this sort of stuff. But I've heard people speculate that it's not likely he's going to do that because he won the case and that was the main thing he wanted. He also will continue to make a lot of money in movies and whatnot that he might be cast in the future. I mean, who knows what will happen in the future for his career, but I think that his career will, you know, start to be revived and that her career will go down the tubes, which, you know, is pretty sad for her. But it won't look good for him because he's trying to get his reputation back. He wants his reputation back. And I think it would harm his reputation if he were to become a collection service, you know. But who knows? I guess we'll find out. And we'll all be talking about it when something happens. Patron Ann from Germany says, whose testimony convinced you the most or stuck the most in your mind? End of question. Yeah, good question. I already talked a lot about the most convincing testimony, the Amber Heard testimony, the audio, and the couples therapist. But your question is a little different. You know, was stuck most in my mind? And what I would say it would be Dr. Curry. I kept referring back to it throughout my reactions to the trial. At first, it seemed like her claims were a stretch, the diagnoses of borderline and histrionic, and the claim that she didn't have PTSD. I remember thinking at the time, like, well, you know, I'll take her word for it, but wow, like, how would she know that from that limited amount of time? You know, it's quite a thing. Plus, like, borderline and histrionic, really? But the more and more data that was presented, the more her conceptualization seemed correct. And she, for the most part, you know, represented herself really well, represented us really well as mental health clinicians. So I think that really stuck out to me. Kate from Oxfordshire says, I wanted to say your coverage of the trial has been riveting. Do you think this trial will impact divorcing couples to gain psychological reports on their partners? End of question. So do I think that as people are going through a divorce, that more and more divorcing couples will turn to forensic psychologists as a way of trying to win their case? And the answer is, I don't know, because I don't work in that field anymore. But I suspect not, because they're very expensive. Like, just the evaluation of Amber Heard that I'm guessing Johnny Depp's team, you know, to pay for Dr. Curry, for example, that I think we learned that that was probably somewhere excess of $100,000. So now, could you get a cheaper one? Yeah, but imagine one that's $10,000 or $5,000. You know, it's a lot of money. So, you know, I don't know. Plus, I think there's some level of a barrier to, you know, doing this. You know, you can't just force someone to go through a psychological assessment, usually, as far as I know, legally. The only reason why Amber Heard had to subject herself to the evaluation from Dr. Curry was because she claimed that she had PTSD as a result of Johnny Depp. Because in her countersuit, she says, he defamed me and now I have PTSD. Somehow she claimed she had a mental disorder as a result of Johnny Depp. And when you claim that, then it opens the door to data being gathered by forensic psychologists. And so you have to submit yourself. But that's why Johnny Depp didn't have to, because he wasn't claiming he had any mental condition as a result of Amber Heard. So in a divorce case, and again, I'm not a legal expert, but I'm far from it, but I'm just going to take a guess and say that as long as you don't claim or you're not suing your partner for damages to your mental health, then you probably don't have to submit yourself to an evaluation. Now, are therapy records pulled during a divorce? Yeah, they frequently are, especially if it's a custody case, because there are often allegations about the other person being an abusive parent or something. And I think that will continue as it always has. Nancy from Kentucky says, do you know why this trial was televised? End of question. Yeah, well, the attorneys tell me that the government wants the public to trust their processes, and apparently transparency increases trust. So that's why they did that. And I'll tell you, once I heard all the explanations from the attorneys, I was like, oh, okay, I guess I could see that. I'm still not a fan, honestly. But at first, I was like, why is this televised? I mean, my goodness, like, this does not need to be televised. It's so personal and so awful. Like, yeah, go to court, have a jury, you know, tell us the result. Do we have to see every single moment? You know, and I guess I was a part of that problem, right? But as I've been saying from the beginning, I'm hoping that I'm destigmatizing both sides to some extent, right? So maybe I would mitigate that sensationalism a little bit. I hope. I don't know. Lena says, I'm happy that Johnny Depp got justice. What Amber Heard did to him was criminal. I'm sorry for the backlash that you've been getting. Please know that your deserving listeners appreciate you, even if they don't agree with some of the speculations that you have concerning this case. Take care. Well, thank you so much. Marta says, hi, Dr. Kirk. What do you think your opinion on the trial would be if the roles were reversed? End of question. Yeah, I answered this in one of the previous episodes because someone else answered the same questions, asked the same question. And the long and the short of it is that I don't think my opinion would have changed much because the data was all there. And I did often ask myself this question, sometimes out loud, as I was reacting to what was happening. But who knows? I mean, gender is a huge part of bias, and I can't get away from that. So who knows? But I don't know. I guess maybe there's a chance that I would have lightened a little bit on Johnny Depp, but I don't know. The data was just so glaring. And I've treated so many female perpetrators that I don't have that bias that much. I think it would have been 5 or 10 years ago when I felt like I crossed this threshold where when I think of a perpetrator, I don't necessarily think of a guy. So because I've experienced so many women who are abusive in various ways. So I don't know if I would have, if it would have changed much, you know. Kate from Georgia says, do you think the trial will have a long-term effect on how society stigmatizes and views borderline personality disorder? End of question. Hard to say. At first glance, I would say yes, definitely, because people on the whole hated Amber Heard, and a lot of people will remember she was diagnosed with borderline, and she might be the only example of borderline that they have ever heard about. And thus, they believe everyone with borderline is like, or at least the way that people see her, which would absolutely add to the stigma of borderline. But it's possible that I don't know. Maybe I'm just too optimistic, but it's possible that the fact that it gave a lot of opportunity for experts and other people to talk about borderline personality disorder, that it might have pushed us forward farther than it set us back, but I don't know. It's hard to say. But I have a feeling that it did increase the stigma, which of course we didn't need more of. Patron Raga from Iceland says, even though I agree with the verdict, I worry about the impact on people with borderline and fear it will fuel prejudice and unfair discussion. Please elaborate. I basically just answered that question. Patron Guru from Norway says, how do you think a person with the diagnosis Dr. Curry gave Amber Heard would deal with going through the trial and then losing a trial in this way? And how would you help them through it as a therapist? End of question. Yeah, I've been here before, actually. I've had clients with borderline and similar personality disorders who were going through a trial like this, not on television, but a very difficult, distressing trial. And it's hard. There's a lot of trauma that gets triggered. The borderline individuals often will regress quite a bit, dissociate, fall into substance abuse, increase in suicidal thoughts, a lot of distress, eating issues, sleep issues, acting out, sexual issues, sliding back in therapy. So yeah, it's hard. And I can think of a few moments, a few cases in the past when I would actually be advising my client heavily that they actually don't participate in, because, you know, the cases I'm thinking about, sometimes the individual, my client, didn't have to participate, or they didn't have to participate meaningfully. And so yeah, it's hard. It sets them back. It's more trauma often, and it's rough. And I just do what I can. I just mainly am supporting them, and I will halt trauma treatment because it's too much to ask people as they're going through that to engage in that. All right, this next question is from Nikki Queens. They write, why do you think people were so interested in this case, and what do you think the reason is for people to feel so strongly about it? End of question. Well, I don't know. I could speculate that it's because famous people are interesting, apparently. Also, Schadenfreude, of course, played a role. Everyone has a bit of conflict with their partner, but we don't usually have a conflict that is that bad or that is that disastrous or that public. And when we see someone else have a gloriously horrific relationship displayed for everyone, and there's all sorts of ridicule and humiliation happening to individuals that are outside of us, it makes us feel better by comparison. Also, I think there's a lot of latent misogyny that was creeping in to the interest and the passion in some people's rhetoric. Also, it's something to talk about. You know, for me and my wife, throughout the trial, we talked about it almost every day because all these new things were happening. And not only with the trial, but also with my reaction video series. And so, you know, our lives are sometimes kind of boring. It gives us a chance. And it gives us a chance to talk with people about something that we can all share. You know, back in the day when I was young, it'd be a TV show like Star Trek or Moonlighting or something. But today, we're all separated and isolated and siloed. And I think the trial gave us something to talk about, which, you know, makes people bond as a group or even as a society. Also, I think there's a lot of people with unresolved trauma that were triggered by the trial and were locked in. A number of people have emailed in talking about that, how the trial was almost like being a moth to a flame or something, and they couldn't stop watching because it felt important to watch, but it also was traumatizing them in the process. And so I think that's another reason. And maybe to a lesser extent, there's a lot of unresolved relational traumas that people don't get a chance to think about or to see other people display. And to see it displayed, I think somehow might comfort people a little bit, to just see like, oh, okay, I'm not the only one that's going through tough times. Patron listener says, do you have any concerns for Amber Heard's baby as her daughter reaches different stages of growth that could trigger someone that might have borderline personality disorder and possibly other comorbidities? Her daughter is who I keep thinking about through all this. Thank you for all your work during and after the trial. End of question. Yeah, it's hard to say. I have obviously seen cases where people with moderate to severe borderline will harm their children, if not flat out abuse them. But I've also seen a lot of people with borderline do really well as a parent. In fact, there are certain things about having borderline, particularly as you recover, that actually enhance one's parenting. So it's hard to say how she will be as a parent, and I could see it going either direction. Patron Elizabeth from Canada says, do you believe with proper therapy and willingness to work on themselves and their relationship, Amber Heard and Johnny Depp could have had a healthy relationship even with their mental health struggles, trauma, and substance abuse issues? End of question. The answer is absolutely 100%. Their issues, if they had come to me, and I'm not saying me only. Well, let me rephrase it. So if a couple like this had come to someone like me and had actually dedicated themselves to all of the services that they needed, you know, getting sober, her individual therapy, working on her relational traumas, their communication in couples therapy, I would assume that things would work out for the better. I've worked with couples that were more difficult than them and were in worse shape than them. So yeah, absolutely. And I consider it kind of a tragedy that they didn't dedicate themselves to the treatment that they needed. Melnell from BC, Canada says, if you accept a diagnosis of histrionic personality disorder along with borderline personality disorder, can you conceptualize that Amber Heard's behavior demonstrates that she was definitely the abuser, and when Johnny Depp finally had enough and he said he was going to divorce her, it triggered her to take action to receive attention through a false narrative of being abused to ensure the attention she received compensated for the injury of her quote-unquote status and quote-unquote fame that resulted from no longer being married to him. I feel like you focused a lot on borderline, but ignored or minimized Dr. Curry's other diagnosis that really revealed more of about Amber Heard's propensity for Machiavellian behavior and deception. End of question. Yeah, I mean, that's got to be the longest but smartest sentence I've ever read on the air before. let's just read this. And by the way, you know, your conceptualization, you know, is pretty great. So let's read this again. If you accept a diagnosis of histrionic personality disorder along with borderline personality disorder, can you conceptualize that Amber Heard's behavior demonstrates that she was definitely the abuser, and when Johnny Depp finally had enough and he said he was going to divorce, it triggered her to take action to receive attention through a false narrative of being abused to ensure the attention she received compensated for the injury for her status and fame that resulted from no longer being married to him? Now, I'm sure if you were to read, if you were to write a sentence like this in English class, people would say it's a run-on sentence. I'm not sure about that, but I like it. Sometimes complicated conceptualizations require long sentences, and you know, I see what you're saying. And I will agree with you that I did not talk much about that. I think mainly because the trial was focused on their relationship before the divorce. But of course, it is a major component to the story, which is, well, if she did lie, why did she lie? Why did she write that piece in the Washington Post? Why did she tell everyone a series of lies if she did lie? And the histrionic is a good explanation of that. But as I've been saying before, borderline could also explain it. But histrionic does seem to fit because... but who knows? It's hard to know. But I think it's possible that your conceptualization is accurate in that if I were to fully assess, I might find that this is a good conceptualization to follow. And one way to think about it is that up until the time of divorce, it seemed clear that Amber Heard, particularly towards the end, was operating from a level of desperation to retain the relationship. She was really desperate for him not to walk away during conflict. She was very sad when he would pull away emotionally and really beg him to not do that. And so it's one way to look at it is that during their marriage, she was provoked or triggered or I don't know, in a situation where her borderline symptoms were front and center, the idealization and the devaluation, the anger and the hurt and the pain and the pursuing was all there and the distorting. But as soon as he broke up with her, then the borderline part of her went to the background, not like dissociative identity disorder, but a defensive structure receded because she also had a histrionic defensive structure that kicked in that is more protective of her ego. And so as her ego is being, you know, shredded due to losing him, just that alone would really hurt her. But also it's so public and she's worried that he's going to tell other people that she's an awful person. And so she goes on the attack and she starts to histrionically make stuff up, seek attention when it's not wise to do so. And is continuing to do that to this day. Is that a sound conceptualization? Yeah, you could argue that. I'm sure a lot of the pro Amber Heard people would take issue with that. But I think if you're looking at the data the way the jury did and the way the consensus of the people did and the consensus of the patrons did, then, you know, that's one way to look at it. I also think that I just tend to not want to entertain that people like Amber Heard are Machiavellian in that way. And I wouldn't even say it was Machiavellian because that implies somehow that it was volitional. You know, like a sadist or a psychopath trying to get you and making plans about it. I think if it were this histrionic defensive structure coming to the fore to protect her ego, it probably is involuntary and distorted as well. It's just, you know, in the same way that you could listen to the audio where she's just begging him and he just wants to go inside and visit his kid and they're in a car together. And she's like, don't go, don't go, don't, please, if you leave, you're killing me, you're killing me. You look at that from the outside, you're like, look, he's just going to visit his kid. You can talk about this again. Like, why are you imprisoning him in the car? It's so distorted, you know. She feels as though the relationship is going to end and that means something really, really horrible to her. And of course, that's not what he's asking. He's just like, can I get out of the car and socialize with my family? I think that's what's happening. And the same goes for histrionic, that from you know, the divorce on from the outside, you'd be like, you realize that all of these lies and all these public statements and histrionics, they're not actually salvaging your reputation. You're putting yourself on the line because you're going to, at the very least, have some kind of battle in the press between you and Johnny Depp, which doesn't look either one of you look good. Or two, you might get sued in court and then you're really up crap's creek. So it doesn't, it's not actually helping you to do this, but of course it feels that way because that's what the histrionic condition is that it feels as when histrionic people feel unsafe and abandoned, they turn to attention seeking behavior because they believe that if they can get attention, then they can feel safe. In the same way that the moderate to severe borderline individual, when they feel threatened attachment-wise, when they feel like abandonment is happening, their solution is to engulf and control and to criticize and to plead and to enmesh. And of course, that doesn't actually work because it pushes other people away. In the same way that if you're really trying to get safe and you're really trying to get people to like you, then you shouldn't lie and you shouldn't demand and you shouldn't put yourself in the crosshairs of a lawsuit. So, but you know, that's the distortion that they're in, and you know, they're operating on a second by second basis. Because it, you know, looked at a certain way, there's no organization to her claims because they were so random and all over the place. And I hear from people's accounts that there are contradictory statements made by her in different legal proceedings when she knows she's being recorded. So there's no organization, and you know, Machiavellian individuals by their nature make plans. You know, they think about things beforehand. And I don't think Amber Heard was doing that. I think she was just operating out of desperation and in a cloud and in a, you know, hazy kaleidoscope of her own defenses and just shooting herself in the foot repeatedly throughout this whole affair. And so, you know, it's sad. I feel really, if this conceptualization is correct, which is possible, I feel really bad for her. I've treated people like this. So, but yeah, Mel from BC, Canada is, you know, pretty smart. Again, for you Amber Heard supporters out there, I want to say that it's possible that all of this is one massive speculative nonsensical thing, which I don't just say to please you. I honestly believe. I've been around the block enough times to know that with the data that we have, which is a fair amount of data, it still isn't enough to know exactly what happened. Could Johnny Depp have been abusive to her a number of times? In addition to all the things that we saw. Yeah, absolutely. I think that the Amber Heard narrative was good in that they were trying to say, look, he was terribly abusive in the beginning, and then at a certain point, Amber said, enough is enough. And so she started to fight back, and that's when the violence from her started happening. You know, is that possible? Yeah, I could see it, maybe. I could also see it being a complete fabrication, but I do know enough to know that I don't know what really happened. And there's also a possibility that there's a third story that neither one of them want to admit to or remember that we would find if we were there. So, you know, it's a tragedy on a number of levels. It's sad. I hope that we can use this as an opportunity, or we have used it as an opportunity, to move forward and progress in our understanding and awareness of these things. So, I don't know. But I think we can all do our part. When this topic comes up at a party or a dinner or in a conversation, then, you know, try, if you can, if you have the energy, to say that, well, what could you say? Well, this is what I would say, and this is what I have said, which is something like, well, it's hard to know what really happened in reality. There's certainly conclusions that people can logically divine from all the data, but what I do know is that we have a big problem in our society and around the world in which people are being abused. And there's a lot of people of all genders being abused, and there's a lot of people of all genders perpetrating. And very, very rarely people will lie about it. So, and the vast majority of victims, particularly by famous people with a lot of means, a lot of money, these victims almost never come forward, but most victims don't come forward. So hopefully with this case, we can raise awareness for that. You know, just kind of dropping that in there, right? Because you might influence a few people around you. Because you could see someone that doesn't really know what's happening walking away from the trial going like, oh yeah, I get it. Women lie. Or borderline people lie about abuse or something like that. And, you know, that would be a tragedy. So, you know, if we all do our part, we might be able to move our society forward bit by bit. But anyway, well, so there are a lot of emails, but I think I'll end this one here as the patron episode. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.